This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 7 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. I'm Carolyn Scott, and coming up on today's programme, Ecuador went to the polls yesterday in the first round of the presidential elections, and despite the socialist candidate Lenin Moreno taking a 10-point lead over his nearest rival, he hasn't yet secured the 40% required to avoid a runoff vote. Centrist French presidential contender Emmanuel Macron has had a hit in the polls following controversial remarks on France's colonial record and gay marriage. Macron provoked outrage on the right by describing colonial rule as a, quote, crime against humanity during a visit to Algeria, while he angered the left by defending those who opposed gay marriage. The US ambassador to Somalia has been accused of a diplomatic faux pas, gifting a cap with the slogan "Make Somalia Great Again" to the African nation's new president. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu held a secret meeting with the leaders of Egypt and Jordan last year to discuss launching a new round of peace negotiations with the Palestinians. We'll be taking a look at what was discussed and why the talks eventually failed. Thousands across the UK today took part in a National Day of Action in solidarity with migrant workers. The One Day Without Us campaign was launched largely in response to last year's Brexit vote, the campaign for which was heavily focused on issues surrounding immigration and the government's lack of action in securing rights for migrant workers currently residing in the UK. And why do police in America have to warn residents not to open the door to any, quote, unfamiliar cattle? All that and more over the next hour on this Monday edition of World in Focus. With 87.2% of the votes counted in Ecuador's presidential election, the socialist candidate Lenin Moreno leads his nearest rival by 10.8%. Although that doesn't yet mean that Ecuador has elected its next president. Jack Foster has more.
From the outset, no one really expected yesterday's presidential election in Ecuador to be decided without a runoff vote. Opinion polling has consistently favoured Lenin Moreno, the natural successor to Ecuador's massively popular outgoing president Rafael Correa, as the man who would win yesterday's vote. But it was never likely that he'd scrape past the 40% mark required to win outright. And so it was, with that in mind, that Ecuadorian politics has enjoyed something of a confusing 24 hours. Initial exit polls seemed to suggest that Lenin Moreno had indeed managed to secure enough votes to win the presidency without the need for a runoff vote in April, which led to an early celebration of victory from the Lenin Presidente campaign.
Gracias.
The Lenin Moreno campaign celebrating victory in Ecuador's presidential election last night. But those celebrations turned out to be a little premature, and the Moreno camp was forced to backtrack as the evening went on and the actual votes were counted, much to the delight of his rival Guillermo Lasso's campaign. Supporters of Guillermo Lasso last night, as it became apparent that voting would move towards a second round in which their candidate will go head-to-head with Lenin Moreno for the presidency of Ecuador on, most likely, the 2nd of April. This is significant for a number of reasons, not least because Moreno's predecessor and political ally, Rafael Correa, won the previous two elections without the need for runoff votes. Indeed, his popularity is somewhat historic in terms of Ecuadorian politics. But the most significant consequence of yesterday's election could have reverberations far beyond the population of 16 million Ecuadorians. This could well be the moment that Latin America's so-called pink tide finally bites the proverbial dust. The term pink tide, of course, refers to the notable turn towards left-wing governments in Latin American democracies during the late 90s and early 2000s. The movement was embodied in a strong left-wing presence across swathes of South America by by the likes of Ecuador's Rafael Correa, Cristina Kirchner in Argentina, Lula da Silva in Brazil, Evo Morales in Bolivia, and of course the late Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. In the space of just over 1 year, however, Argentina and Brazil have both turned sharply to the right politically, and Venezuela, under Chavez's successor, Nicolas Maduro, continues to struggle economically and is becoming more and more isolated internationally. Ecuador may not have been the biggest player in the pink tide, but if it turns its back on socialist politics, it will deal a hugely symbolic blow. A prominent member of the Bolivarian Alliance, or ALBA, and a major funder of ALBA's Telesur news outlet, and an ally of the likes of Venezuela and Cuba. That symbolic blow would, of course, be music to the ears of Guillermo Lasso and his supporters. He's a banker, he's pro-business, and perhaps most significantly, he wants to improve economic ties with the United States. And with the vote yesterday as tight as it was, it's not going to be easy to predict which way the runoff election will go in April. Suffice it to say, it will most likely be very close. For both sides, there's a lot riding on the outcome, and it's not just the future of Ecuador that's at stake, but that of politics across Latin America. Ecuadorians find themselves poised now on the edge of history, and which direction they choose to go in will undoubtedly leave a legacy which lasts far beyond a four-year presidential term. Jack Foster, World in Focus.
Well, we're lucky enough to have Jack Foster in the studio now to discuss this further. Jack, will there definitely be a runoff round now?
Oh, Carolyn, you know me better. I'm not going to make any definite calls, because all that will happen if I say there isn't going to be one or there is going to be one tomorrow, I'll be back here saying, oh, just ignore what I said yesterday. Well, first of all, it's probably best to describe for our listeners, if you haven't been following this the whole way through, how the system works. It's a two-round system, which is also known as a second ballot or a runoff voting, and it does sound quite complicated if you're not used to voting in one. But it's not actually that complicated. It's a very simple idea. You elect a single winner. You cast a single vote for a candidate. But if no candidate receives a certain required number of votes, which is usually a majority of about 40 to 45%, with a winning margin of 5 to 15%, then you move on to a second round where you just have the two candidates. And obviously the winner of that will have to get over 50%, because that's how percentages work, Carolyn. In Ecuador, it's a 40% win with a winning margin of 10%. And at the moment, as you said at the top of the show, 87.2% of the votes have been counted. And Moreno is currently sitting on 39.09%. Now, it's feasible that with the rest of the votes counted, he could maybe go over the 40% mark. But at this stage, we should probably assume that probably won't happen, because it's not very many votes left to count. There'd need to be a pretty big shift in them. He does have a 10.8 percentage point lead, though. So, of course, if he did tip over 40%, then it would be a win.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, up till now, in a race comprised of eight candidates, Lenin Moreno has been the clear front runner. But how would that lead translate to a two-horse race between Moreno and Lasso?
Well, if it translated simply and basically as all those who didn't vote for Moreno in the first round, then obviously Guillermo Lasso would win with over 60% of the vote, and it would be quite a landslide, even by Ecuador's terms. Undoubtedly, though, it's probably a lot more complex than that, and we'll need to see where those votes go in a runoff, whether or not they will coalesce around Lasso in a push to the right, or if they'll drift away. We'll probably get a better idea over the coming weeks as fresh polling appears just between those two candidates and see how people are likely to vote. Although, it's probably also important to note that all of the polls, massively underestimated Lenin Moreno's share of the vote by quite a big margin, sometimes 10%, in fact even more than that in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're all talking about the presidential election today, but there was actually a referendum held simultaneously, wasn't there, on tax havens?
There was a referendum held, and a historic referendum, in fact. Ecuador is now the first country to have held a national referendum on the issue of tax havens. The idea of it, well, the question on the ballot, as we talked a little bit about on Friday's show, is do you agree that for those holding a popular elected office or for public servants, that there should be a prohibition on holding assets or capital of any nature in tax havens? Obviously, a yes vote to that would see politicians and civil servants being banned from having bank accounts or companies based in tax havens, and they would have a year in which to transfer their assets, and if they didn't, they would be removed from their posts. The exit polling at the moment points to a yes vote in that referendum, which would be a pretty big moment, and certainly the polls, it looked like a fairly comfortable yes vote. But given the last 24 hours, I would perhaps exercise a bit of caution and say that we should maybe be careful not to reach any conclusions before the official counting is done.
Well, I'm sure you'll keep us all up to date on that. Thank you, Jack. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 10 minutes past the hour. Now, Emmanuel Macron, the centrist French presidential contender, has taken a hit in the polls following controversial remarks on France's colonial record and on gay marriage. Macron had overtaken François Fillon, the Conservative candidate and former favourite, when Fillon became embroiled in a corruption scandal, but the latest polls indicate that the two candidates are now neck and neck. Macron provoked outrage on the right by describing colonial rule as a, quote, crime against humanity during a recent visit to Algeria. For more, here's Liam O'Hare.
Well, Macron has attempted to end the controversy triggered by his comments by apologising in public over the weekend. But they weren't the only statements he made that have upset voters. Macron also angered those on the left by saying that right-wingers who opposed gay marriage had been stigmatised and humiliated under President Hollande's socialist government. Well, earlier I was joined by Professor James Shields from Aston University. I asked him how much the recent comments have damaged Mr. Macron.
Well, it's all a question of perspective and definition, but we normally associate crimes against humanity with genocide, so-called ethnic cleansing, slavery. It's not a description we expect to be associated with France's colonial rule. Okay, it opens a debate on a subject that's too easily covered over, but I think Macron was crude and ill-advised to say what he did. There are two especially touchy periods in French 20th century history. One is the collaborating Vichy regime of 1940 to 44 with its collusion in the Holocaust. The other is the Algerian War of 1954 to 62 with all the brutality, torture and massacres that were involved on both sides. And any politician who ventures into either of those hugely polarizing areas has to tread very carefully, and most will steer clear altogether.
But what does it say about the French national psyche, if you like, that somebody saying that colonialism was wrong, was a crime, which many people would think in the 21st century that is a pretty much agreed upon position, that those comments caused such a scandal?
Yes, the problem lies in the two narratives of French history, if you like. France as the cradle of liberty, equality, fraternity, and the great republican values flowing from the revolution of 1789. That on the one hand, and on the other, France as a country with deep and still unresolved issues over historical periods that have seen those great values overturned by hatred, brutality, discrimination and repression. Whether we're talking about the Dreyfus Affair of the late 19th century or the Vichy regime of the 1940s or that ugly eight-year war to hold on to Algeria.
And in terms of Macron's other comments this week that have caused a bit of controversy, he made comments about gay marriage, basically saying that voters who have opposed gay marriage have been stigmatised by Hollande. Do you believe that he, in seeking to perhaps reach out to both left and right, is actually achieving neither and is actually annoying both of these camps?
This is exactly the problem for Macron. That's it precisely. His strength and his difficulty at the same time lies in being of no fixed abode politically. In other words, trying to transcend the old left-right divide and appeal to both sides. This is an advantage at a time when established political parties are increasingly held in contempt and seen as remote and out of touch. But it's a difficulty trying to hold together such a wide coalition of perspectives and interests. In the past week, Macron has tried to appeal to the left, but upset the right on France's colonial past, and tried to appeal to the right, but upset the left on same-sex marriage. And he's drawn attention by that to the fact that he's walking a tightrope between the two.
And in terms of, obviously, Marine Le Pen's Front National, polls suggest just now that she will top the first round of the presidential election. Is it beyond the realms of possibility that Marine Le Pen could actually top the second round of presidential election as well?
No, it's not beyond the realms of possibility. It still seems to me very unlikely, if you think of the mountain Marine Le Pen would have to climb to win the second round. There is, if you look at recent elections in France, in fact, we can go right back to when her father made it to the second round in 2002, there's still very strong evidence of an anyone but Le Pen, an anyone but the Front National vote turning out massively in the second round of elections, where there's a risk that the Front National will win. We saw this in departmental elections a couple of years back. We saw it in regional elections a couple of years back, where the Front National was poised to win certain departments and poised to win certain regions and won nothing because of the mobilization of the anti-FN vote. Now, I think that's still something that Marine Le Pen will face in the second round of the presidential election, no matter who her opponent is. On the other hand, the conditions at the moment, the mood, the political climate, and the difficulties that her opponents are running into all seem to suggest that her chances are getting better and better. I would say that her chances of winning the first round now seem very strong indeed, but she's got that mountain to climb to piece together the kind of electoral coalition that would see her over the line in the second round.
Professor James Shields, as always, fantastic to get your thoughts on World in Focus. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, the US ambassador to Somalia has been accused of a diplomatic faux pas, gifting a cap with the slogan Make Somalia Great Again to the African nation's new president. But faux pas aside, we'll be taking a look at the challenges that the new president faces in Somalia in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one, better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk programme has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys
when and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik.
On Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Tune in!
Well, maybe mention like central bankers and you know, markets are doubling down. Not, you're saying everybody's doubling down. They're crazy.
They are. Everyone's crazy.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, the US ambassador to Somalia has been accused of a diplomatic faux pas after gifting a cap with the slogan Make Somalia Great Again to the African nation's new president. But faux pas aside, we'll be taking a look at the challenges the new president faces in Somalia. The United Nations is rushing to build more shelters around Mosul ahead of an expected wave of displacement from the city, Daesh's last stronghold in Iraq. The scramble comes as Iraqi forces begin their advance on the western half of Mosul, home to the narrow streets of the old city. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu held a secret meeting with leaders of Egypt and Jordan last year to discuss launching a new round of peace negotiations with the Palestinians. We'll be taking a look at what was discussed and why the talks eventually failed. And residents of Suffield, Connecticut were a little taken aback yesterday by a warning from their local police department not to open the door to any, quote, unfamiliar cattle. This is World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. I'm Carolyn Scott and it is 21 minutes past the hour. Now, the new president of Somalia will be inaugurated on Wednesday. Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo was chosen by the Somali parliament earlier this month. He previously served as the country's prime minister in 2010 and 2011, at the time playing a key role in mobilising the Somali army to fight alongside African Union troops to push the jihadist group Al-Shabaab away from the presidential palace. Shortly after his victory earlier this month, Farmajo said, quote, "Today is a new beginning for Somalia. It is the start of a war against terrorists. It is the beginning of a war against corruption," end quote. The electoral process in Somalia was a long and complex one, with open elections deemed impossible due to the ongoing conflict with Al-Shabaab, several tribal wars and an ongoing humanitarian crisis. There were celebrations in the streets of Somalia when Farajo was elected, and within the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya, which is home to hundreds of thousands of Somali refugees. While some critics argue that the electoral process entrenched divides across the nation's many clans, the elections were widely seen as an important step toward democracy. The UN Special Representative for Somalia said that the poll was a brave thing to do and told the UK's Guardian newspaper, quote, "There are a lot of problems in Somalia, of course, but it is not a place falling apart. It is a place coming together," end quote. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the jihadist group Al-Shabaab, which is prominent in much of southern Somalia, have announced that they oppose the election of the new president. In the first official statement since the elections, a senior official from Al-Shabaab stated that the celebrations seen in Somalia had been, quote, organised by paid NGOs. He also claimed that the new president was not a patriot as he had dual citizenship. Farmajo previously lived in America and carries an American passport. But the new president's relationship with the US was put to the test a little on Saturday when the US ambassador to Somalia gave the president a gift that many have suggested was slightly inappropriate. He presented a baseball cap in the colours of the Somali flag with the slogan "Make Somalia Great Again." This caused confusion and turmoil on social media, with many questioning why a Trump-esque slogan would be an appropriate gift to the new leader of a nation included in Trump's travel ban executive order. To discuss this and more, joining me on the line now is Dr. Laura Hammond from SOAS at the University of London. Thank you for your time today. Just to reflect on the electoral process and looking at the comments from the UN Special Representative that it was a brave process, just how remarkable or impressive was this electoral process?
Well, it was impressive in the sense that it defied expectations. And so, you know, people thought that the high levels of corruption that had been reported would result in the incumbent coming back and basically buying a new term. And it seemed ultimately that the parliamentarians decided that they wanted to vote for a change. So, yeah, so in that sense, it was quite remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the jihadist group Al-Shabaab have given their first official comment since the poll, and they claim he's not a patriot. The new president, that he has dual citizenship and he can't represent the people. Though, is it not pretty much to be expected that Al-Shabaab would oppose any new president?
Sure. And Al-Shabaab would certainly always oppose whatever president it is. The fact that he's from the diaspora really has nothing to do with it. So, there are always debates about in Somalia about the extent to which the political future should be determined by people who've spent a lot of time away. But the fact also remains that those who've been away often have a lot of the technical and political skills that are needed to lead the country. So what was unusual about the previous government, previous president, Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, is that he wasn't from the diaspora. And that was an unusual thing because most of his predecessors had spent time outside the country.
It's not just the situation with Al-Shabaab that the new president has to deal with, though. You have these semi-autonomous regions. Do we know much about President Mohamed Abdullahi's Farmajo's view on these regions and how he might deal with those?
No, it's an open question, really, of how he will approach the federal sort of structure of government. One of the first things that he'll need to do, the very first thing he needs to do, which he's doing now, is to address the growing problem of food insecurity and potential famine in the country. But once this immediate humanitarian crisis is over, the next thing he really needs to think about is constitutional reform. So the constitution of Somalia has been set up, and unfortunately it contains a few loopholes that don't provide a clear enough blueprint for how the federal regions should relate to the center. And so that will be a process of negotiation and discussion with the federal states, whether he will be, like his predecessor, very keen on a strong central government with a sort of weaker federal component with federal constituent states, or whether he's embraces some other kind of model, perhaps with stronger federal states or with some states being stronger than others. We'll have to see.
Just one final thing, and it's perhaps on a bit of a side note, but there was a bit of a uproar on social media when the US ambassador to Somalia gave a gift to the new president, which was a cap that said "Make Somalia Great Again." Now, there has been quite the mixed response. Do you think that given that Somalia is one of the countries that was part of the executive order to create a travel ban on behalf of President Trump, it was perhaps not the most appropriate gift to give?
I think it was entirely inappropriate and completely unfair to put the Somali president in the position of asking him to pose for a photo op with such a so-called gift, particularly only days after having been the subject of this executive order banning Somali nationals from entering the U.S. It was completely insensitive and really a kind of cheap, political ploy on the part of whoever decided to do it. I'm not sure if it was the ambassador to Somalia from the U.S. or someone else, but really unfortunate.
I do wonder if they have a few of them made up in the colours of other countries' flags to just give to new presidents around the globe. I wonder if we'll see one after the French elections and after the German elections.
Exactly. Well, right. You would, but would you go around saying, make France great again or make the UK great again? It's a completely patronising position as well to suggest that Somalia is an appropriate recipient of such a gift. If they want to make Somalia great again, they can lift the executive order and facilitate remittance flows back from the U.S., from the diaspora communities to supporting famine relief in Somalia. That would do a lot more than their hat.
Well, Dr. Hammond, a pleasure to speak to you again. Thank you for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Dr. Laura Hammond from SOAS at the University of London there on the challenges faced by the new Somali president, Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo, and the perhaps inappropriate gift given by the U.S. ambassador.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
It's 28 minutes past the hour. This is World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. I'm Carolyn Scott. The United Nations is rushing to build more shelters around Mosul ahead of an unexpected wave of displacement from the city, Daesh's last stronghold in Iraq. The scramble comes as Iraqi forces begin their advance on the western half of Mosul. This is thought to be the toughest nut to crack in the Iraqi government's months-long attempts to retake the city. For more, here's Liam O'Hare.
While tens of thousands of Iraqi troops and allied forces launched an offensive in October last year to retake the city, which has been in ISIL control for over 2 years. Months of fighting have seen the Iraqi forces break into the eastern neighbourhoods of Mosul, where there have been heavy street-to-street battles with the militants. And now they are set to battle for the west of the city, ISIL's last major urban stronghold in Iraq. Well, earlier I spoke to Elizabeth Koek from the Norwegian Refugee Council. I asked her what the humanitarian situation is like in the city.
Yes, indeed. There was an announcement yesterday morning by the Iraqi Prime Minister that the military offensive to retake the west of Mosul has indeed begun. What we know so far is that the humanitarian situation inside the city is quite dire for people. We, as aid agencies, have not been able to access people in ISIS-held territory for almost 3 years now, especially in the case of West Mosul. So people previously were relying on the commercial routes that were open. However, in November, those routes were predominantly closed. And so we are hearing reports of people saying that their food stocks are running low, that their medical equipment and medicine vaccinations are running low, and that the water quality is below the quality that you would need to use for domestic and both domestic and personal use.
And yeah, I was just going to ask, in terms of on the ground practically, what can you do as an aid organisation to support people, bearing in mind there's so much conflict going on in the city?
Absolutely. Well, as aid agencies, we stand ready for those who manage to flee the areas where active fighting is ongoing. This means that the humanitarian community has been able to set up displacement camps and emergency sites. This also means that while it is very difficult to provide aid and assistance to people who are currently still in active conflict, we are exploring different modalities to ensure that we can get supplies into the city, especially now that the conflict continues and people have not had access to basic goods since November.
And obviously we know in any conflict, in any war that goes on, civilians do are involved in it, and civilians do pay a price. How much are civilians paying a price in Mosul just now, and do you think enough is being done to protect civilians from being casualties?
I think this is a very important question. We are incredibly concerned about the lives of civilians. At the moment, we think that about 800,000 people are inside West Mosul. We're particularly concerned about the old city. The old city of West Mosul is a very densely populated area where we believe that about half the people currently reside. So that means that 400,000 people are at severe risk as the fighting continues. What we've seen so far in the context of the Mosul operations is that the government of Iraq has made a commendable effort to protect civilians in the context of this fighting. They've communicated with civilians what the safest option is, obviously bearing in mind that no guarantee of safety has been given to people. In the east of the city, this meant that the Iraqi security forces informed civilians that the best option was for them to stay inside their homes and benefit from the protection that they would be able to provide. What that looks like for the West Mosul, and particularly the old city, is going to be a big challenge, because the old city is so densely populated. So it'll be very difficult to then escape, especially if heavy artillery, mortars will be employed to fight the battle. So what needs to happen and what needs to continue to happen is to have the protection of civilians at the heart of this military operation.
And just in terms of the media coverage as well, it seems that the humanitarian situation in Mosul has not perhaps received as much coverage as elsewhere, quite rightly. Obviously, there was a very big media focus on what was going on in Aleppo recently. Do you believe that media has failed to really pick up on the humanitarian situation in Mosul sufficiently?
We're in constant contact with media sources, and that's an exchange of us providing information to be able to provide the general public with a good idea of what's going on in Mosul and to highlight the plight of civilians. So I think that cooperation definitely needs to continue, and that light needs to be shown on the situation inside the city, especially as these military operations continue. It is incredibly important that information comes out of the city, both to inform the humanitarian response, but also to inform the international community on what the needs are of these people who are trapped inside the city, so that we can provide, so that the funding comes through for us to provide a response that meets the needs of people who are currently trapped.
Elizabeth Kowek from the Norwegian Refugee Council, we very much appreciate you speaking to us today. Thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Breaking news, expert analysis, and exclusive stories, all in one place. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
This is World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 35 minutes past the hour. The Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz reported on Sunday that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was presented with a peace initiative just over a year ago at a secret summit organised by the then US Secretary of State, John Kerry. Netanyahu met with Jordan's King Abdullah and Egypt's President Sisi to discuss the proposal at a summit in Jordan that was overseen by Secretary Kerry. The plan, however, ended in failure, and the records of the meeting, including why Netanyahu decided to reject it, until now have been kept secret. To take a closer look, here's our correspondent Matthew Ayton.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu held a secret meeting a year ago with the leaders of Egypt and Jordan in a failed attempt by the Obama administration to broker a regional agreement on Israeli-Palestinian peace, reported the Israeli newspaper Haaretz on Sunday. This seems to tie in with Netanyahu's call at a White House press conference last Wednesday with US President Donald Trump for a more regional approach to peace.
If anyone believes that I, as Prime Minister of Israel, responsible for the security of my country, would blindly walk into a Palestinian terrorist state that seeks the destruction of my country, they're gravely mistaken. The two prerequisites of peace, recognition of the Jewish state and Israel's security needs west of the Jordan, they remain pertinent. We have to look for new ways, new ideas on how to reinstate them and how to move peace forward. And I believe that the great opportunity for peace comes from a regional approach, from involving our newfound Arab partners in the pursuit of a broader peace and peace with the Palestinians.
Haaretz cited unidentified senior officials in former US President Barack Obama's administration who said that Netanyahu, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, Jordan's King Abdullah, and then US Secretary of State John Kerry all met on February the 21st, 2016, in the Jordanian Red Sea resort of Aqaba. However, the plan to bring other Arab states into the fold eventually withered on the vine after Netanyahu allegedly withdrew his support, suggesting that opposition within his right-wing government tied his hands. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas did not attend the meetings, but was reportedly kept up to date by Secretary Kerry throughout the short-lived process. Netanyahu's office has declined to give a comment on the report, and the office of Egyptian President Sisi issued a statement saying that some of the details of the report of the meeting were incorrect, but did not deny that the meeting ever took place. Jordan is yet to provide a statement. John Kerry became renowned for his shuttle diplomacy efforts between Israel, Palestine and regional actors in an effort to kickstart a new round of negotiations. Kerry launched a final bid to try and forge peace after talks between both sides fell apart over issues such as Israeli settlement building in the occupied territories. On the sidelines, at the Munich Security Conference, Israeli Defence Minister Avigdor Lieberman said that he supported the creation of a Palestinian state, saying that, quote, "the end game is no doubt a two-state solution." According to Haaretz's report, the two-state proposal outlined by Kerry and presented at the summit a year ago called for the recognition of Israel as a Jewish state by the Palestinian side and the resumption of negotiations with the Palestinians backed by Arab nations. It also called for the, quote, just, agreed, fair and realistic solution to the Palestinian refugee issue that is consistent with two states for two peoples. King Abdullah and President Sisi allegedly tried to convince Netanyahu to accept the proposal, but the Israeli PM tried to push a proposal of his own and requested that a regional summit be arranged to discuss this, which would have included delegations from the Saudi government, the United Arab Emirates, and other Sunni nations. Well, joining us to discuss this in further detail is Professor Niamh Gordon of the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, who specialises on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Professor Gordon, thanks for talking to us here on World in Focus. So Mr. Netanyahu rejected the proposal put forward by Kerry, John Kerry, Egypt and Jordan. He said that the reason for this was because of the protestations from the right of his party. How much truth is in this, do you think, or is it more likely that he just didn't agree with the proposal? I mean, they had a real shot here, it seems. Why didn't they just take it?
I don't think that Netanyahu wants to withdraw from the Palestinian territories Israel occupied in 1967. I think ideologically he's for the greater Israel. And I think that pragmatically he doesn't have the courage, because what's most important for him and has been throughout his career is maintaining his seat rather than carrying out political change. And so there's a constant, his allies in the coalition are on the right, some or many further right than him. And therefore, he had to do a certain calculation whether he wanted to maintain this coalition and or try to change a coalition and carry out a courageous act that I'm not sure he believes in. So the odds were close to zero of anything actually happening.
During his press conference with President Trump, Prime Minister Netanyahu spoke about how he wants to launch a region-wide effort to solve the Palestine-Israel conflict. But, I mean, he had that in some proportion in this deal with Egypt and Jordan, didn't he? Why do you think it is that he wants to include states like Saudi Arabia and the UAE too? What can they bring to the table, do you think?
I think Netanyahu is interested in maintaining the status quo. And I think in one of the studies I've carried out, that any time there's negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians or the Americans or other parties, then the settlement project in the colonized territories actually expands. So the status quo actually is used to deepen and bolster Israel's colonial project. And so he's now trying to create a new coalition of the Saudis, who already have a plan. I mean, the Arab plan was written by the Saudis and was suggested by the Saudis. And it's like rehatching again and again the same proposals and the same, while the issues are very clear. The issues are withdrawal from the 1967 territories, the division of Jerusalem so that it can be both the Israeli capital and the Palestinian capital, and the acknowledgement of the right of return for the Palestinians. These issues are not going to go away, and it doesn't matter which parties are going to be invited to the table and when. And so I think that it's all about stalling. It's all about maintaining the status quo as Israel incrementally creates more and more settlements and moves more and more settlers from the pre-1967 borders into the West Bank.
Mm. So do you not think that this talk about region-wide efforts will make much of a difference, really? Because, I mean, let's be honest, it seems that unless the terms of peace negotiations change dramatically and the Likud are given essentially a free pass by the international community to expand settlements and preclude the possibility of a contiguous Palestinian state, it seems that they're not going to take any talk seriously. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I think I would even say more than that. I would say that a contiguous Palestinian state is no longer really an option, and that the whole terms of debate and issues need to change, and what we actually need is a paradigm shift from a two-state solution to one state. De facto, there's one state on the ground between the Jordan Valley and the Mediterranean Sea. That one state has existed for the past 50 years. And the question now should be, instead of two states and how to reach two states, is what do we do with this one state? How do we take one state that's actually, in many respects, an apartheid regime and democratize it? How do we create power sharing between Israeli Jews and Palestinians in this one state? And here we can take examples from the Good Friday Agreement and from other agreements about different ways of creating a government whereby the different parties share power in an egalitarian way. Mm.
And just finally, many have pointed to how President Trump has shifted his position a lot on Israel during his campaign, saying he didn't see the settlements as precluding peace, then saying that he thinks they're unhelpful. It looks like his administration doesn't even have a foreign policy strategy here, really. What do you make of this?
I think they don't. I think that Trump really does not know any of the details. I think he's just says what enters his mind at the moment, and he can change it the next moment. And in many ways, that is very problematic. But in some ways, it can also be liberating. So, for example, in the last press conference, Trump tells Netanyahu it can be two states, it can be one state, and kind of brushes aside 30 years of U.S. diplomacy of this two-state solution. But he suddenly opens up a certain debate about the one state. This was not his intention. But now we can start, if the president of the U.S. says we can start speaking about one state, okay, let's start speaking about one state. What does one state mean? Who are citizens in this one state? Why are the Palestinians currently not citizens in this one state, and so forth?
Okay, Professor Niamh Gordon, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Tough questions are the most powerful weapon we have. As long as you have questions, we'll keep asking. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, thousands across the UK today took part in a National Day of Action in solidarity with migrant workers. The One Day Without Us campaign was launched largely in response to last year's Brexit vote, a campaign for which was heavily based on issues surrounding immigration. We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
We're all doing together, you ready? You ready? Max and Stacey together having oral sex. Here we go. 3, 2. Hi, Stacey.
Double down, double down.
I'm doubling down with you, baby.
Double down.
We got a new show on Sputnik.
It's markets, finance, business, economics, ka-ching, bling, and
all kinds of good stuff. Only on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Doubling down.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they send me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one, better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman program
on Radio Sputnik.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, thousands of people across the United Kingdom today took part in a National Day of Action in solidarity with migrant workers. The One Day Without Us campaign was launched largely in response to last year's Brexit vote and the UK government's lack of action in securing rights for migrant workers currently residing in the United Kingdom. And why did police in an American town have to warn residents not to open their doors to any, quote, unfamiliar cattle?
Today, we're nowhere to be seen. Today, we're where we've always been.
Right here, with a right to stay.
That's the work that we are doing today.
Because we are not a bargaining chip, not an absent line on a Bridget slip.
We're a drain on the welfare state.
Not a stranger to blame or to hate.
We do the work you want us to do.
We pay our taxes when they fall due.
Yes, we live with you and work with you.
We're part of this place we travel to.
We are part of your today and your tomorrow too.
So, today,
join the day without us.
That's a snippet from the promotional video for the One Day Without Us Day of Action, which took place across the United Kingdom today. Thousands of people took to the streets in support of migrant workers in an attempt to hit back against the, quote, politics of division and hate in the fallout from the Brexit referendum, which polarised opinion on immigration. The Day of Action was called by campaign group War on Want, the Bakers Union and the RMT Transport Union under the banner One Day Without Us, promoting the theme of, quote, migrant workers are welcome here. The call for action was largely in response to last June's referendum on the UK's membership of the European Union, which was dominated by the issue of immigration, with calls for Britain to be able to control the influx of migrant workers from Europe. However, War on Want points out that migrant workers play an essential role in the provision of healthcare services, transport and hospitality. War on Want Labour rights campaigner Owen Espley told Sputnik reporters earlier today, quote, the referendum campaign and the aftermath has involved scapegoating of migrants and blaming migrants for society's ills. We think this is wrong. The US President Donald Trump represents for many people the politics of division and politics of hate, and that's why people are concerned about what's happening in the UK, the rise of racism and xenophobic violence after the Brexit referendum, end quote. Thousands of organisations have taken part in the Day of Action, posting images on social media of what workplaces across the UK would look like without migrant workers. You can follow that using the hashtag One Day Without Us.
This is Radio Sputnik.
This is Radio Sputnik, this is World in Focus, and finally for today, police in Suffield, Connecticut issued a rather humorous warning at the weekend informing residents not to open their doors to any unfamiliar cattle. In a post on the police force's Facebook page, they showed a picture of two dairy cows which had escaped their field and were roaming around a residential street, looking like they were waiting on someone to answer the door. The post said, quote, earlier this morning, officers responded to a complaint of two suspicious males going door to door trying to sell dairy products. Officers determined that the two individuals did not have a solicitor's permit and were apprehended after a short foot pursuit. We would like to remind everyone to never open your doors to any unfamiliar cattle, end quote. And that, on that note, that's all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget you can listen again to this and to previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment we hand over to Washington DC for the Tom Hartman Show. And until tomorrow, from myself, Carolyn Scott, and the World in Focus team, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Black mayor, black chief of police. I would say the thing that is missing is a black middle class who actually have good manufacturing jobs in the area, which just doesn't exist because of our insane trade policies. We have run up this multi-trillion dollar trade deficit. We buy all this junk from low-wage countries. They end up with our dollars. They don't want to buy anything we make, so they come over here and they buy our buildings and whatnot. You can't have a middle class if you don't have manufacturing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me that, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs program, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Breaking news, expert analysis, and exclusive stories, all in one place. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Catch all the breaking global political and economic news as it happens. Sputnik brings an all-star lineup with expert opinion from some of the biggest names in the news today. Noam Chomsky.
Turkey, U.S. ally, their main goal is to attack the Kurds, the one ground force opposing ISIS. And there have been a kind of a funnel for support of ISIS, not officially, but in practice.
Peter Sunde, co-founder of the Pirate Bay.
We don't have any sort of democratic control over the internet. And I think that we're very naive when we think that the internet itself is intrinsically good. It's not. It's just a very neutral technology that is being used for good things, but more and more being used for evil things.
Icelandic Foreign Minister Gunnar Bragi Sveinsson.
increased activities in the Keflavik Air Base, and that has to do with more activities from the Russian Northern Fleet in the ocean around Iceland, and also, of course, these usual flights of the bombers.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
We're the ones that destroyed the government of Libya. We're the ones in a pipeline dispute that helped destroy the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. We're the ones who invaded Iraq.
Former U.S. Secretary of Defense William Perry.
The hostile relationship between the United States and Russia today is dangerous for both countries, not because either country would actually want to start a military conflict, but because there's always a danger of blundering.
Sputnik talks to the brightest minds in politics and current affairs to find out what's really happening. Tune in.